می برگردی؟ حیاتو که نوی چورده یه بیدی که همینه یا مقدی و از این جانتو و چه وشته یه هفته چیزا بیه. Hello, my relatives. I'm very happy to see all of you here tonight, and it's with a good heart that I greet all of you with a handshake. I am Wazir Toni, and I'm a Dakota from the Upper Sioux Reservation located in southwestern Minnesota, but currently I'm on faculty in the Indigenous Governance Program here at the University of Victoria. And before we go any further, I just want to start out by saying or acknowledging that we are on Lekwungen territory, that this is occupied and unceded territory of Coast Salish and Strait Salish peoples. And I think it's particularly important to remember that, and remember that places like institutions like the University of Victoria, cities like Victoria, were all built, were all constructed at Indigenous expense. The expense of Indigenous peoples, the expense of Indigenous lands, the expense of Indigenous waters, plants, animals, all Indigenous life has suffered here so that these institutions, these cities, could be built. While I'm giving acknowledgments, I also want to say thank you to several programs on campus. The Indigenous Governance Program, Social Justice Studies, and Human and Social Development all help sponsor this event and make it possible. So I want to say Kadamiya Wolvia Echichiaki to all of those departments. Now maybe I can talk about Derek Jensen, which is, I know why you're all here. Derek Jensen has been called the poet-philosopher of the ecological movement. He's written more than 15 books critiquing contemporary society and the destruction of the environment. His many books include A Language Older Than Words, A Culture of Make-Believe, Endgame, What We Left Behind, What We Leave Behind, Resistance Against Empire, and coming out in the spring, I believe, Deep Green Resistance, which I'm very much looking forward to. And so that's kind of his standard bio, but I also want to talk for a few minutes about why I love the work of Derek Jensen. He is a revolutionary intellectual who writes in defense of the land. And I can say that as an Indigenous woman, I think the first time I read Endgame, it was the first time that I heard or read the words of a white man who was writing in defense of the land, not just calling for maybe a kinder, gentler treatment of the environment based within the current structures and institutions, but instead trying to address the root problems. And so he has an excellent critique of industrial civilization. And in his work, he provides very compelling evidence for why this way of life is inherently unsustainable. And rather than talking about how we can tweak the existing system to make it more land-friendly, to make it more life-friendly, his call is to bring it on down. I've been waiting my whole life for this. So, for me, as an Indigenous person, as a teacher, as an activist, as a writer, dedicated to Indigenous decolonization, there's a lot of room for alliances with people like Derek Jensen and for that mission. Because when I talk about decolonization, I'm talking about overturning all of the systems and institutions of colonialism, the systems and institutions that have kept all Indigenous life in the Western Hemisphere oppressed. And I think there's a lot of work we can do together. So with that, please join me in welcoming Derek Jensen.
So before we actually do the talk itself, I want to read you something I wrote just recently, and then also also, I may as well go ahead and explain this. As a lot of you know, I have Crohn's disease, and what's happened has been really painful, but it's a great metaphor for the dominant culture. Crohn's disease is, of course, a disease of civilization. Non-industrialized peoples don't get Crohn's disease, and reasons for it don't really matter anymore. And in my 20s, they gave me a miracle drug for Crohn's disease, which is prednisone, which a lot of people have probably taken. It's a very, very common drug, and it's miraculous. Unfortunately, it kills your bones. It's kind of bad. So because my ankles were killed by the prednisone, I had cadaver ankle replacement surgery. And I had this one done in January and this one done in September. And so the reason this is a really interesting metaphor is because, okay, the dominant culture creates this problem of Crohn's disease, and then it solves it using prednisone. And unfortunately, prednisone has this other problem that it kills your bones. But it's great because actually civilization will provide a solution to that too, which is taking a bone from a dead person and putting it in your leg. And then presumably this is going to cause another problem, which can then be solved with another high-tech solution, which you see where this is going. And it's a treadmill that for a long time I hesitated to use the word apocalypse. Partly because of all those cartoons I've seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, and in part because of the power of the word itself, I didn't want to use it lightly. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, "So Derek, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? Will it take the death of runs of salmon so large that you could hear them for miles before you'd see them, so large that you couldn't see the bottom of the river?" There was one run of salmon in 1932 up in Alaska that was 12 miles wide and lasted for 30 days. Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons. They were so large, they darkened the sky for days at a time, flying 60 miles an hour and sounding like rolling thunder. Maybe it'll take... Do you know why there aren't any penguins in the Northern Hemisphere? There were. They were called great auks, A-U-K-S. And there were so many that on just one island, a French explorer said you could load every ship in France and it wouldn't make a dent. Well, they did, and it did. And the last one was killed in the 19th century. So my friend said, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? Will it take global warming, hole in the ozone, take dioxin in every mother's breast milk on the planet? What's it going to take, Derek? When do we finally use that word? What are the false hopes that keep you tied to the system? And what will it take to eradicate those false hopes? But the problem, one of the smartest things the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Do you want to get an ID card, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to move to a ghetto, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to get on a cattle car, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to take a shower, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. But I'll tell you something very important, which is the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. No, listen. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. Keep that in mind over the next 10 years. The problem, though, isn't just false hopes, but hope itself. I was doing a talk in Colorado several years ago, and I was bashing hope just gleefully, and someone in the audience shouted out, "What's your definition of hope?" And I said, "I don't know. I've been bashing a beard. I have no idea what I'm talking about." I asked the audience, "So what is your definition of hope?" And they came up with a great definition, which is hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. That's how we use it in everyday language. I'm getting on a plane Friday morning. Okay, 6:30 in the morning. I'm getting on a plane Friday morning, and when I'm in the air, I hope the plane doesn't crash, because I have no control. On the other hand, I don't hope that I eat something tomorrow. In fact, I don't hope I eat something tonight. I know that men are supposed to be afraid of commitment, but I will commit to you here in public that I'm going to eat something tonight. Because it's in my control. And so, once again, you know, I was doing a talk one time, and there was a 7-year-old kid in the audience, and I said, what would happen if your parents told you to clean your room, and you said, I hope it gets clean. And the kid said, somebody has to clean the room. And I asked my mom one time what she would have said to me if I would have said, when I was 7 or 8 or 9, if she would have said, clean your room, and I would have said, yeah, I hope it gets clean. My mom said, yeah, you better hope it gets clean. So when people say that they hope that global warming doesn't kill the planet, what they're doing is acknowledging they have no power. And if people say that they hope that salmon survive, what they're saying is they have no power. So the truth is, I do not hope that coho salmon survive. I will do whatever it takes to make sure they survive. If they don't like how they're being treated and they want to go away, I will say goodbye and I will miss them. But if they don't want to go extinct, I will not allow the dominant culture to drive them extinct. I will do whatever it takes. I do not hope that coho salmon survive. And the last thing I want to mention is a tradition of the Cheyenne dog soldiers called the pick a pin and stake. Before a battle, a few of the bravest Cheyenne dog soldiers were chosen to wear sashes of tan skins called dog ropes. Attached to each dog rope was a picket pin normally used to tether horses. During battle, the pin would be driven into the ground as a mark of resolve. Once the pin was driven, the dog soldier would remain staked to a piece of ground, even to his death. Retreat was no longer an option. The pin could only be removed when everyone was again safe, or when another dog soldier relieved him of his duty. It is time. I have driven my picket pin. I am staked out and willing to give in no more. Where will you drive your own picket stake? Where will you choose to make your stand? Give me a threshold, a specific point at which you finally stop running, at which you finally fight back. Stand with me. Stand and fight. I am one, we will be two. Two more might join, we will be four. When four more join, we will be eight. And there will be eight people fighting, and others will join, and then more people, and more. Stand and fight. The questions before each of us now are, what are your gifts, and how can you use them in the service of your land base? What can you do? What does your land base need from you? How can you achieve it? What do you want to do? And right now, perhaps the most important of all, what are you willing to do? People ask me all the time, Derek, what do you want us to do with all this analysis and information? And I always say, I want you not to listen to me, because I don't know how to live sustainably. I don't know how to live here. If you want to know what you should do, you need to ask the land, you need to ask the ocean, you need to ask the salmon. They know how to live sustainably, and they know what they